Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today, we're talking about Fantastic Beasts and where you might find them. New York City, apparently. That's where you might find them. And we also have a special guest with us today, a certain Matt Cox.
Hello.
Hi. Happy to be here.
So happy to have you, Matt. Yeah, thanks for coming on.
We're very happy to have you, Matt.
Cool.
And Matt, you're going to be our resident Harry Potter expert.
Great. That sounds like me.
Don't let us down.
I won't. I'll know everything.
But Matt is a playwright, and he wrote a very specific play that's about a sort of magical school.
Yeah, sort of, you know, it's mostly unrelated. but it's called Puffs, or Seven Increasingly Eventful Years at a Certain School of Magic and Magic. And it's, you know, it's pretty similar. It's of the world, but from a different perspective, and some might say.
It's really funny, and it's enjoying a very successful run on Off-Broadway right
now. That's right, at the Electra Theater.
The Electra Theater.
43rd Street. Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and now Sundays.
It's pretty big, man. And it is really, really, really funny. It's a great play.
Thank you.
But anyway, Fantastic Beasts is a movie set in the Harry Potter universe, and it takes place in the year 1929, right? Or is it 28?
26.
26. It's way off. And it follows Newt Scamander, who brings a mysterious case filled with magical creatures into New York City, and obviously hilarity ensues. I will be talking about the beasts and Fantastic Beasts because I feel like they're the like real stars of the movie, and I'm gonna get into like some two beasts in particular, into like kind of the background behind them, and Claire's gonna be telling us about
the production of the movie and why it got made,
which is very cool. Matt is gonna be chiming in with his tidbits of knowledge about Harry Potter throughout, and we're gonna have a little Q&A with him.
Great. At
the end of our sessions, and we'll all talk about Fantastic Beasts and what we felt about it. So yeah, let me get started. Fantastic Beasts, the creatures. So like I said before, as far as this movie goes, I think the beasts are really the actual stars. And one of the best parts of the Harry Potter books were probably, for me anyway, are the creatures. And I liked that this movie was gonna like give them kind of a center stage. At least that's what it seemed it was gonna do, is like gonna be all about Fantastic Beasts and catching them up. So I'm going to talk about my two favorite creatures from the movie. And the first is the legendary creature, the Thunderbird.
Yes, and these are, I don't think it's huge spoilers to mention. There's a lot of these Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, there's a lot of these Fantastic Beasts in the movies.
A lot of them.
Surprise, one's a Thunderbird. They're in America. So aside from being one of Pontiac's most successful muscle cars... The Thunderbird is actually a creature of Native American lore that can be found throughout different Native American cultures. And it's kind of cross-pollinated. It's in a bunch of different tribes and areas of America.
Does the Thunderbird come up in our earlier books? Do you guys know?
I don't think it's ever been
mentioned
before all of the Pottermore stuff.
Yeah. One of the funny things in the movie is he's trying to take this Thunderbird to Arizona. It's one of those like minor plot points. For the most part, the Native American tribes in Arizona, they didn't have Thunderbirds.
Oh, that's fun. Ooh.
But that wasn't part of their cultural lore. But what they did do is like in the 1920s, when a lot of like East Coast city dwellers decided that the Southwest was a really cool place to vacation, they would go down there, and a lot of the Native Americans around there would make jewelry and charms and stuff. And one of the charms they happened to make was a Thunderbird. And it sold so well that even though Thunderbirds aren't really a part of their culture, they're like, all right, well, we're just making a lot of Thunderbird jewelry from now on for these tourists.
It is now, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
But so anyway, what as far as what Thunderbirds are, they're giant birds, sometimes described as jet black, but sometimes they're said to have like a bunch of brightly colored feathers, and they often control the weather. They're pretty much always credited with making thunder as well through the beating of their large wings, and...
What tribe did they originate with, if it wasn't in Arizona?
Oh, it's a bunch. Like the Algonquin were one of the big tribes that feature Thunderbirds. A lot of the tribes in the Pacific Northwest, like where you see them on totem poles. They're almost always at the top of a totem pole. The Menominee, which was a tribe in like Wisconsin, Michigan area, along with the Ojibwe, also, which is like the kind of Canadian border area.
So even though the tribes aren't, say, like... connected per se. This mythology runs throughout all of
them. Yeah, it runs throughout all of them. And even though they all speak a pretty different language, you know, it's still a mythology that runs through all of them. But the Thunderbird takes up different roles based on like whatever tribe it's associated with. So the Algonquin Thunderbird, it typically is like the Thunderbirds control the upper realm, which is like the area where we live. And they're constantly in a battle against these like water creatures that control the lower realm. So they're always like fighting with each other and stuff. And in the Menominee tribe they were around Wisconsin, they kind of control the rain and the weather. And the Ojibwe, they were created by this spirit, the Nanabazo, and they enforce morality on humans. And Thunderbirds can be very wrathful. Like they're wise and they're mostly a force for good, but like if you piss one off, he's gonna mess you up.
Greek gods, where like they're not always good, and they do human things, like sleep with other women, their wives.
From what I read about Thunderbirds, what legends I read, they're mostly a lot nicer than Greek gods. It's like, this, you know, there have been. I did read this legend that wasn't about a Thunderbird. Actually, it was about one of the serpents that the Thunderbirds fight against, who had turned into a man and married a woman. And but he was actually the serpent guy was actually a pretty nice guy, so so even though they're warring with the Thunderbirds all the time, that it was pretty interesting that the serpent was created as like a, or was portrayed as a nice kind of person.
I don't remember any of this from the movie.
No, they didn't quite go in. I mean, in the movie it does control the weather and it does almost attack our friend.
You're right.
But yeah, I have to say, they had a lot going on in the movie.
You're right.
So to go into that kind of depth.
You're right.
Yeah. One of the other things they mentioned in the movie is that Newt Scamander, played by Eddie Redmayne, he says he finds this Thunderbird in Egypt. It's like a really small part. It's like that's where he said he found the Thunderbird and he's trying to take it back to America.
Was it smuggled there or was there illegally for whatever reason?
For whatever reason, it was there illegally. But it made me think of a different legendary bird that also came from Egypt called a roc, R-O-C. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that.
I have heard the name, and I feel like I read it in first grade when I was really into the Egyptian gods, but I don't remember it.
Same.
Well, it's like a Middle Eastern / Indian version of, I guess not quite a version of a Thunderbird, but it's like this humongous bird that's supposed to be able to eat elephants, you know, like pick them up off the ground and take them off to their cave, and like these sailors and stuff would like have sightings of rocks and, you know, oh, there's a rock over there. And it made me wonder that, like, do you have a Thunderbird, Eddie Redmayne, or do you have a rock? And you're just, you're going to the wrong place anyway, because there are no Thunderbirds in Arizona.
He's very bumbling.
He is pretty bumbling. But yeah, rocks were supposed to be so big that they could pick up an elephant, and they were... actually, there's a funny story accounting of Marco Polo and Kublai Khan who go on a hunting trip, apparently trying to find a roc
and bring it down. Did they actually
do it? I read a source that said they went all the way to Madagascar trying to find a roc, where in Madagascar at that time there was something called an elephant bird, which was a flightless bird that stood 9 feet, maybe even 10 feet tall, that went extinct in around the 17th century. So that was like...
Do you think they went all the way to Madagascar? Madagascar is that little island off of
off the coast of Africa. That's a long way.
That's a really long way.
But Kublai Khan, I don't know. Maybe he could have.
I don't think Kublai Khan went to Madagascar.
Well, that's... In doing research for this podcast, looking up fantastic beasts, a bunch of cryptozoologist stuff came up. Like, cryptozoology is that thing where these, like, scientists, quote-unquote... Like they try to discover these animals that have like that are in myths and folklore and see if they like actually existed, if there was inspiration for them. And a lot of cryptozoologists think that the Madagascar elephant bird was kind of the inspiration for the mythical roc.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense. Yeah. I just don't believe Kublai Khan and Marco Polo went to Madagascar.
Who knows, Claire? Kublai Khan was very well traveled.
That's where the belief ends, right there. Magical creatures, yes.
So that's kind of my Thunderbird talk. Next, I want to talk about the Okamis, or the Akamis. How did they call them in the movie?
Oh, I don't remember.
What one is the Akami?
The Akami is that big blue serpent that fills up.
Oh, I think Akami.
Was it Akami?
I think so. I might be wrong and just sound like a moron.
I think you're right.
You're right. Whatever you say is right.
Yeah. Matt,
you're right. I'm the expert.
Harry Potter expert. His word is law on Harry Potter.
Yes, I believe it's called an alchemy.
As he pushes his glasses further up his nose. All right, so when I got into the alchemies, I went down like into the dark, weird places of the internet finding stuff on the alchemy because I thought it was pretty cool. And I think the alchemy is a really good example of like classic J.K. Rowling creativity just shining intensely. And I wish more focus was put on this alchemy. So what is an alchemy? In the movie, an alchemy is a winged serpent with a kind of beak that is hatched out of an egg made of silver and will grow to the size of whatever space it's in to fit. So like, the, you know, you first see them and they're very small in the smaller space, but one gets loose and it's huge. It's like filling up this big house, or it's like a library or something. I can't remember.
I think it's Macy's.
Is it Macy's? No, I think you're right. I think it is Macy's.
Supposed to be Macy's, yeah.
It fills a Macy's. 34th
Street.
So I was trying to figure out if the alchemy was based off of anything because it looked extremely familiar. And the first thing I want to focus on is the name alchemy. So alchemy is spelled very similarly to a certain Franciscan friar / theologian / philosopher named Occam, who had a really big, he made a razor. A razor in philosophy is a tool you use to shave off possible answers or hypotheses. If you have a bunch of hypotheses for the way one thing is, a razor is something in philosophy that you use to like narrow down which hypotheses you could or couldn't use.
Hypothetical.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So Occam's razor states that among competing hypotheses, the one with the fewest assumptions should be selected. So the hypothesis that you have to make the fewest assumptions for is the one that is most likely to be true. In Occam's razor. And I thought that was kind of funny that J.K. Rowling would create this creature called an Occam, you know, which, and all these beasts actually, which, you know, you need a lot of assumptions just to even believe that Harry Potter existed and this whole world exists. I was like, is she just trolling us or something? What is the deal with this alchemy? But then I realized where I'd seen that creature before and why I recognized it so much. And I've seen it in an anime called Full Metal Alchemist.
Are you guys
familiar with that?
I've seen most of it, yeah.
Remember, you know the homunculi in Fullmetal Alchemist?
Mm-hmm.
They've got that Ouroboros symbol, yeah, like tattooed on them, like Gluttony's got it on its tongue. And I realized that like, oh, that's also like a way that you could look at this alchemy. The alchemy largely resembles the Ouroboros symbol, and Ouroboros is the circular snake that bites its own tail. And it's a symbol that's seen in almost all world cultures. It's pretty ubiquitous. And it's a big symbol in like ancient alchemy, what alchemists like back in the day in Europe would use. It was normally associated with the philosopher's stone, which is the thing that all the alchemists were trying to create. And the reason that all this ties in with the creature alchemy is because the actual word alchemy is also an old, out of use bastardization version of the word alchemy. So like J.K. Rowling.
Wait, put it all together for me, like in one sentence, because I think I'm lost.
So the alchemy, which is the creature,
right,
resembles this ancient alchemaic symbol.
Right.
And alchemy, the word, is also a bastardization of the word alchemy itself.
Oh.
And the alchemy looks a lot like that Ouroboros symbol, that which you see all over the place. And also the fact that it grows to fit whatever room it's in fits in with the tail of the Norse Ouroboros symbol, Jormungandr. And that was the serpent that was let outside and ate and ate and ate and grew until it encompassed the entire world.
She's so cool.
Okay. That all does make sense.
Yeah. So it's like, and it's not a creature that like existed really anywhere. Like she kind of pulled all this out of her imagination, and like the where it comes from, I think, is so interesting. Like that she could create this. I mean, like obviously the symbol's been around for a long time, but that like this cool creature was like created by her.
Whenever we talk about mythology on this podcast, especially European mythology, J.K. Rowling always comes up because she always has like done something with whatever mythology.
But she normally like tweaks it.
She tweaks it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the Thestrals from Harry Potter?
Mm-hmm.
That's just her own thing. Those aren't really based off anything else either, or they're based off a bunch of different things that she kind of turned into her own unique creation. This alchemy is the same thing. One of the other interpretations of the Ouroboros symbol is that it's a symbol of infinity and self-renewal, and I wonder if this is like the Illuminati, J.K. Rowling, telling us that we were going to be watching Harry Potter movies until the end of time. Like this.
I believe it.
And that's what you got from this movie.
That's
the biggest takeaway.
Gosh, if you Google Ouroboros, you find some weird stuff. You go down some weird holes. And that's my segment, guys. Those are the two creatures I decided to focus on.
It's really cool, Kyle.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I learned something.
You learned something, Matt.
You're welcome.
And I'm the expert.
Claire will hopefully learn us something more.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it's going to be just as insightful, let me tell you. And all the reasons that we'll be watching Harry Potter forever are also in my segment. So I'm going to talk about the book, the original, my gosh, what's the book called?
Fantastic Beasts? Sorcerer's Stone.
Oh, Fantastic Beasts.
I just had a brain fart. So the original Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them was first published in 2001, and it talked about the made-up animals in the world at Hogwarts, and it was written as a textbook, and the idea that it appeared in, like, the syllabus list in Harry Potter.
Yeah, Hagrid is the one who assigns it. That's the one. Yeah. Hagrid is magical creatures. Spoiler, if you haven't read Harry Potter, Hagrid becomes the professor of magical creatures.
It comes up in the Philosopher's Stone, though, so it's in the first one.
Oh, does it really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then there was this, before the book was published, there was a 3-year gap. I don't know if you guys remember this, but I remember this, in between the Goblet of Fire, which is the 4th book, and the Order of Phoenix, which is the 5th book.
Mm-hmm.
And J.K. Rowling, in interviews that I read about her, said the pressure of the Harry Potter books had gotten so intense that she needed a break. And I do believe that the 4th book is really when the craze started hitting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, I remember too.
Because that was the first one that I had trouble getting the first day it came out.
Yeah.
Because I got the 3rd one the first day it came out. And the 4th one, I got the last copy of it at a bookstore, at a Barnes & Noble.
Did you go at midnight?
No, I went in the morning, which was my own fault. That was your own fault.
But we didn't know.
At the time, the midnight thing wasn't a thing.
Whenever have midnight book releases been a thing?
Yep.
I feel like that's
really
unique
just this
to Harry Potter.
J.K. Rowling changing the publishing industry.
Yeah.
Or just her.
Yeah.
No one else has done it. And in this gap, she also released Quidditch Through the Ages, which is another quote-unquote Hogwarts library book, or book that's mentioned in the Harry Potter story.
It's a sports book.
Yes. Sports book. Yes, the history of sports. And all the proceeds from the books were donated to a charity called Comic Relief. And besides a brief intro outlining Newt Scamander, who is the main character in the movies, achievements and accomplishments, and the name of his wife, Porpatina Goldstein, and kind of a vague mention of their fate, it didn't offer a lot of details about Newt himself, who actually was a Hufflepuff. Mm-hmm. Matt, I'm sure you know. I'm sure you've heard.
Yes. Unrelated.
Unrelated, though, yeah.
And it kind of gives a lot of guesses about what kind of beast he might have encountered. And I was actually trying to get a hold of the copy of the book for this podcast, and it's being re-released in March of next year for a much heftier price.
It's poor timing.
Yeah, wouldn't you think that they would release it with the movie?
That would be, because holiday, a lot of people probably want that book right now.
Yeah, and there's suckers like me who are doing podcasts on it who
want to
read
this
book. Go ahead.
I was just thinking, unless they're going to surprise release the second movie in March, unbeknownst to anyone, you know, drop it like that Beyonce album.
That would be a really good time.
I think they're releasing the screenplay of the movie as like a book.
Yeah, I could have bought that, but I wanted the actual book.
Okay, yeah.
That's what kept on directing me to the screenplay every time I would click on Fantastic Beasts. But when J.K. Rowling was writing this textbook, she said she became very interested in Newt Scamander. And of all the characters in Harry Potter that are just a name mentioned, Newt is the one that took on a life of his own in her mind. So she is writing, she is the screenwriter for this movie we talked about earlier. It's her screenwriting debut. And I think part of that was this idea of this character that she was interested in.
Yeah.
So I'm going to backtrack a little bit and talk about the producers. They're David Hyman and Lionel Wingram. And these are actually the two original producers on the original Harry Potter film franchise. David Hyman's company, Heyday Films, is the company that bought the rights to J.K. Rowling's first 4 books in 1999. I remember when that happened.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, and they bought it for about $2 million, which is a steal.
That is a steal. Yeah,
that's a bargain deal.
Yeah.
They were shopping at Costco for Harry Potter rights.
For $2 million. he says he was in the right place at the right time, basically.
Wow.
And a little bit of background on him. He's British. And when he bought these rights, he had just come back to England after working in Hollywood with the idea that he wanted to really shake up the British film scene. I don't remember British films in the 90s. I don't know if you guys do. If you don't, it's because there weren't many.
Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, there was Four Weddings and
one
a Funeral.
Movie.
They've got one.
They got one. But it wasn't like a place where like British filmmakers were making great work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he had worked in Hollywood. He'd worked for Warner Brothers, and he had a relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And it was actually with this relationship, as you can see, that he managed to create one of the most successful film franchises in history. And he's actually giving a decent amount of credit for transforming the British film scene.
Oh, okay. You know, Steven Spielberg was originally going to direct the first one. Yeah, and the reason that didn't work out was because there were some disagreements on the casting, because Steven Spielberg wanted to cast, like, American actors. Mm-hmm. Haley Joel Osment, I believe, was the pick to play Harry. And J.K. Rowling kind of shut that down.
Probably
and then now
better.
We get that beautiful British cast. That
yeah.
Right, wasn't that one of her things that all the cast had to be mm-hmm. British?
Yeah.
I mean, later, I also read something from Spielberg where he was like, yeah, I mean, it was just easy money. There was no, like, challenge in it. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. I don't know if that's bitterness.
Oh, Spielberg.
It's true words. Or maybe it was pulled from out of context.
Yeah,
who knows?
Yeah.
So he was saying, the producers were saying that after they'd worked on all of the 8 films and they'd finished, they had really mixed feelings. Like, it was a family going their separate ways, and but they were leaving on a really good note and a really high note, and they were excited to move on and make other films. Some of these other films have been Paddington, the animated movie, mm-hmm. Gravity, which Sandra Bullock was in.
Good one.
Wait, they produced
Gravity. David Heyman did, yeah.
Cuarón?
Alfonso Cuarón. Mm-hmm.
Alfonso Cuarón, he did the third Harry Potter movie,
That's right.
So, you can see the connections.
Look at those connections.
Yeah.
And apparently they missed the world, and they were just sitting around wondering what else they could do with it. And Wigram thought maybe about doing a documentary about Newt. And so they told J.K. Rowling their idea.
You're getting British. I have an idea.
And she responded with, how about we do a film about him instead? And they say that her idea was much better than any kind of documentary. and that they were originally nervous about her writing the script because she's a novelist mm-hmm. and she'd never written a screenplay. And being a great novelist doesn't make you a great screenplay writer. And she wrote the original draft, and then the director, David Yates, who directed the last 4 Harry Potter films, so the 2 from book 7, 6, and 5, and Steve Kloves, he's credited with writing all the Harry Potter screenplays, but on this film, he's just credited as a producer, worked with her on the rewrites. and David Yates said it was really exciting to work directly with J.K. Rowling on the screenplay because he hadn't gotten to have that relationship with her in the movies when they were adapting the books.
Yeah.
And then I think this is really interesting about the movie and the tone. Yates said in an interview that her screenplay writing process is really about her finding the story she was most passionate about. And it was a lot of experimentation. And about 2/3 of the way through, she wasn't sure if she wanted to write the next screenplay and was really frustrated with it. And then she started getting her stride. And then it became a thing of like, oh, I'm going to write the second one and I'm going to write the third one. Mm-hmm. And then as a writer, he says she just can't stop writing. And when working on the second script for the film, she had done a draft and Yates had asked her for like a 12-page outline of the structure plot. And then 2 days later, he got 102 pages of a half treatment, half draft. Just like, oh yeah, here you go. And like, she can't help herself, they say. And also that she's just so good at outlining everything. There's a really great story where in the 5th movie, when they had to write the black family tree on the wall, mm-hmm. I guess they weren't prepared and they had to call her and be like, can you just do like a really little one for us, please? And 30 minutes later, she had one written up for them going back 6 generations. Like, she just knows. She plans it out, and she plots it out, and she knows everything. On October 13th of this year, it was announced that the upcoming film would be the first of 5. It was originally supposed to be a trilogy, but now it's going to be 5. And I believe that's J.K. Rowling. She made the announcement. She was like, well, I hadn't really done the plotting, but now I've really done the plotting, and it's going
to
be 5.
And to do it right.
Yeah. And I mean, if you've read any interviews with her beforehand, she just plots everything. There's so much of like, this is going to go here and this is going to go here. And even reading interviews about other writers talking about her, they've said, I don't know a single writer who plots like J.K. Rowling does, who takes the time and like the paperwork to do that. Like she does it, I think she does it written out too.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I always wondered that like, if she had plotted the series when she was writing the first book. And apparently when you reread it, like you can see that she definitely did.
Oh,
like there's stuff in the first book that
makes
is a huge part in later books. Like it was planned.
She always said that she knew exactly what the last sentence or the last word was going to be the whole time she was writing it.
Really?
Yeah. And that was, I think though, that ended up changing because they added the epilogue scene into the last book.
Yeah.
I think the word scar was supposed to be the last word. I remember, I think she said that a long time before.
Yeah. I got chills just now, just hearing it. I love her so much. I'm going to just talk really briefly about the stats because we always do that. After the first weekend, it's made $75 million in the U.S. and Canada. I was part of that. And internationally, it's made $143.3 million.
Wow.
It's definitely made back the $180 million it cost to make Matt's a writer. Cost to make the movie.
Not only is he a Harry Potter expert, he's our writer expert as well.
I'm expert in writing. Know everything about writing.
It hasn't done as well as any of the other Harry Potter movies, which...
Oh, interesting.
Really?
I think that's expected. I think
it's time.
Yeah. It's time and it's not Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
I actually, if it wasn't for this podcast, I don't think I would have rushed to see it opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And the Warner Brothers distribution chief called the box office results magical.
He's like, I'm going to get to buy that island in Dubai.
That I always wanted, yeah. As far as CineScore goes, CineScore is when they pull audiences on opening weekend and they like average out what they thought of the movie. It got an A audiences have really been enjoying it. And it has a 76% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is where they average out all the critic scores. So audiences love it. Critics give it a C.
Yeah, mostly like it.
Yeah. So that's my production.
Production time?
Yeah, production time.
Fun, fancy production time.
Yeah, and I guess we'll go back to what we thought about it, but we're going to talk to Matt about writing his own play that has...
That's magical.
Magical. Very magical.
Magical play.
We've talked about like all the lore in Harry Potter, and we've both seen the play, and we both really like it. Also, disclaimer, our producer is in the play.
He is. Yes. He's got a very small role.
you can see it and just miss him.
Yeah.
You can see it. But I feel like my first question that I thought when I watched the play is, how many times have you read Harry Potter?
So I grew up with the series, like, and I think I've been trying to pinpoint exactly when, if it was either the second or the third one that I started reading, like when they came out. I think it was the third one I got on the release date for the first time. I found the books in my school's library because we had a thing called AR points, where it's like if you read a book and you would take a quiz on a computer and you got points for how many questions you got right. And then at the end of the year when the Scholastic Book Fair came, you could use those points to purchase either books or book-related items. And so I was just kind of reading everything. So I picked up the Harry Potter books. I was like, oh, these are great. And then by the time the fourth one came out, that's when I like was like, oh, my God, these are great.
Yeah.
And then became really obsessive with it. And so then, but honestly, though, between, like, whenever they were just originally coming out, and every time, like, whenever, like, the sixth and the seventh one came out, I did a reread of the series both times then. But after the seventh one came out, I really didn't think about it or touch it for a while. And then when I would go see each of the movies. And it wasn't really until I had the idea for Puffs that I reread them, which was fascinating. I highly recommend reading them as an adult. Because you pick up on a lot of different things, and they are just really, really well made, well crafted books. It's a really cool story that was just so much great, like heart and meaning to it. But yeah, only a few, I guess, like probably four or five times I've probably read the series overall. Yeah,
because the level of detail in Puffs is so amazing. I'm going to have you explain what Puffs is in a great, second, because I realized we hadn't done that yet. But I was just so impressed with, like, oh my gosh, I don't remember those details. I want to reread the books and then go see it again so that I can actually pick up on all the jokes that I think I'm pretty sure I missed. But really quickly, tell us what Puffs is about.
Great. So the easiest thing, remember, just completely unrelated to anything else we've been talking about. So Puffs is it takes place over the 7 years at a certain famous wizard school that a certain famous boy wizard, whose name may or may not be Harry, was there, but it's from the perspective of a group of students in a certain house, I did air quotes, that we call the Puffs. So see if you can figure that one out for yourself about who they're supposed to represent. And it's kind of just like we have our own little trio that's in there, but it also uses the characters, versions of the characters that are similar to people from the books. And it's just kind of how they live their lives for those 7 years. The idea started from, like, I had a thought on a train. I was like, man, for all the other kids at that school during that time, it would have just been terrifying.
Yeah.
Because they're just trying to get, they're 10-year-olds or like, they're 10 to 17-year-olds.
They're just trying to pass their owls.
They're just trying to learn how to be wizards.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like, one of the teachers ends up being real evil. There's a giant snake that starts killing people. There's these weird soul-sucking monsters. One of their friends dies in a sports tournament. And it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So it's kind of just that idea of, man, it would be just terrifying. And so we look at it through the eyes of our own, like, trio of characters who are so their main characters called Wayne Hopkins, Oliver Rivers, and Megan Jones, who are actually people from, there's a list of students who were at the school based on a list of the author of a particular book series that we've been talking about quite a bit. I'm very trained to not say their names. But they're on a list of students. They're just never mentioned in the books by name, actually.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah.
So they are technically real students at the school. And one of them I finagle which house they're in because it's one or the other. And so it's just kind of their own little story, and it's kind of a lot of fun winks and nods to the book series, while also like a love letter to it. And it parodies a lot of like moments from it and a lot of like Harry stuff. But it's also got this kind of own story about, like, you know, being important in like a celebration of like side characters.
Yeah.
Life.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, I feel like, especially for people, I mean, you talked about this in other interviews, but for especially people who love Harry Potter,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they can be, but I feel like it's the nerds.
Yeah, yeah.
Potter, and like, they're not the like sports heroes of their school.
Yeah.
And
yeah, as a person who grew up like that, you know, a bit of an outcast. It's a certain mindset that like latched onto it before, you know, the masses latched onto it too, which is great and fine. You know, those are the people who I think it means particularly more to, are people, you know, who I think our message will resonate with them.
Yeah, when you're not the chosen one.
Yeah, exactly.
We talked to Lee Bardugo actually about that in a previous podcast, who's an author, about writing a story about not the chosen ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially like from a fantasy standpoint.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Almost always about the chosen one.
Exactly.
If you think of all the fantasy books that you like and read.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who are the people who sit next to the chosen one?
Exactly.
In class.
Exactly.
In wizard class.
How much picking through the book did you do? Or
yeah.
did you just have like, oh, I'm going to highlight this moment. Or, oh, I'm going to highlight this moment.
So I had like the moments that I remembered specifically just from like having been such a big fan of it as a kid. And teenager and young adult, of like moments I was like, oh, those will be really funny. And then whenever I did the reread of it in like preparation of writing it, that was whenever like specific moments would stand out and be like, oh, I've got to try to do something with that. And that's why there is actually probably at this point more cut material from Puffs than there is like material in Puffs that were like kind of specific plays on moments from the books. Like there was a whole detective scenario where like one of the students realized that one of the professors who's faking being the real professor in the fourth one, like they knew about it, little things like that. And there was even a lot of the times I like had just misread something and had written a whole thing that somebody eventually came up to me and was like, that's not a character. Like, you've done this wrong. I was like, uh-oh. And I had to change a complete character from it just because, you know, it's a lot of information.
Yeah.
My fault there. But yeah, it was a lot of it was just kind of just doing the reread and picking and choosing things as I was going through it, which was fun. It was an interesting way to read a book.
I feel like it's easy. You could easily write a play on just one of those books potentially. So
oh,
like
yeah, yeah.
when you're like looking for moments in seven books.
Yeah, that was it was the toughest thing about it was getting it to be all seven books.
Yeah.
And still make sense as a story. Yeah. So it's like kind of finding the picking and choosing particular moments. Otherwise, we'd have a 3-hour play, two parts.
And obviously, the fans have been super receptive because this has been running for almost a year now, right?
From when we started at the Pit. Yeah, we've been almost a year. That started in December. So.
And do you find like they connecting with them and that fan base, is it intimidating? Because we talked about not doing a Harry Potter show for so
because
long.
Because fans are so into it. And we're both fans. Like, I loved the Harry Potter books, but
I'm not that big.
Originally, we were like, no Harry Potter, no Star Wars. But we're breaking both those rules.
Oh, great. The fan base, actually, because I've had a lot of interactions now with them, especially through, there's a group called The Group That Shall Not Be Named, which is a meetup group in New York City. They're wonderful, wonderful, and a very large group. I highly recommend looking them up if you want to just find people to talk to about. They're just like the nicest, most like loving, and they want to be really supportive of something as well. That just like, as long as you do your homework and aren't like trying to like exploit it, which is something that we very particularly like made sure we weren't doing. We weren't people being like, this thing will, people will pay money to go see this thing.
Yeah.
It was like, how do we actually like lovingly craft a thing that pays homage to, you know, what it is and what makes people like it. And that's something that I think has resonated with the fan base. With our show, at least, like, they respect it, I think, from a certain point, because we, you know, really try. And it's coming from people who all really like it. But, yeah, no, I've had a lot of interactions with people, and it's been great. They're a great bunch of folks.
And then just for the podcast and for fun, I have a couple quick questions for you. What house are you in? If you took it on, I'm sure you took it on.
I took Unrelated website. But, I am a Puff.
Okay.
I got the Puff. So that was good.
Did you want to get the Puff?
I did want. So, you know, that might have, you know, who knows how.
If you'd taken it with a clear mind, which you might have been.
Exactly.
Well, you know what? But Harry wanted Gryffindor so bad.
I could have asked. Yeah, you're right.
He's sitting at the computer, please be Hufflepuff. And the computer's like, only a Hufflepuff would ask.
Yeah.
And then who's your favorite Unrelated to your show? Who's your favorite Harry Potter character?
Oh, that's interesting. I've never really even thought about that.
Maybe like a couple characters.
No, totally. I was a big fan of Mr. Sirius.
Sirius.
He's cool. He's just a cool guy. He's a good character in it. Oh man, I want to give a good answer for this because it's a question I haven't gotten, and I've gotten a lot of the questions.
It's Dobby, isn't it?
Oh yeah, you're right. Yep, that's who it is. Yeah, you got me. You figured it out. One of the characters that I just really liked whenever I did the reread, I really loved the second minister that's in it, Rufus
Scrimgeour.
Him.
Oh.
He's not in it for very long, but that character, he just from like a narrative standpoint, it's exciting. He's like an exciting thing. His arrival is exciting. And the same with, because my favorite chapter in the books is the one with starts, I think the sixth or seventh one, where the minister meets the real prime minister
meets
of England.
That's one of my favorite parts of the book. That's like how it opens, right?
It's great, yeah.
That is a great scene.
Otherwise, then I'd probably just go with your typical the potions teacher.
The potions teacher.
He's a good one. Oh, and I also really love I'm trying to think of how to not say the names. The werewolf teacher. Werewolf defense teacher.
Yes.
He's great.
I think so. But yeah, no, man, that's actually very difficult to pick out a favorite character. They're all great. They're good characters.
I think, I think about, like, what's my favorite book or what's my favorite movie, and I was spending a lot of time on Pottermore, as you do.
You can really get sucked
in. Thinking about, like, oh my gosh, what do I like best? Like, what am I clicking on the most? What am I most interested in? It's funny. Like, and how big the world is and how much that there is.
Who's yours, Claire?
Certain twins.
Every
time they're in the book, I'm just so happy to have them.
They're
what
about
fun. You?
I like the outer space living certain maybe from the smart house who's Harry's game.
It's like outer space.
maybe her name is a different word for the moon.
Oh yeah, it could be.
She was always my favorite. I had a crush on her. I remember I read Order of the Phoenix more than any of the other ones. It was always my favorite.
Because of her?
I think that was a big reason why. I just liked her so much. I thought for sure her and the main guy, we're going to get together, and I was a little bummed when they didn't.
Oh, I knew. I never saw that coming.
there's kind of an implication of it at the end of that book.
That's
so yeah, never quite.
Never clicks.
Should we talk about our movie?
Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah.
And where to find them. Yeah, let's talk about it. So guys, just want to let you know that coming up in our editorial section, there will be some spoilers for Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So if you've seen the movie, all well and good. If you haven't seen the movie but don't really care about spoilers, go ahead. But if you do really want to like get everything all at once, go see the movie and then come back to us.
Matt, you should go first.
As
an expert.
As the expert. Well, so like we all went and saw it after our show, so the opening night of it. You know, there was a certain nice little buzz. I think that there's a lot of great things going on, and it's an entertaining movie to watch, but I do think it has a lot going on. There's a lot of different plot lines happening all at once, and it doesn't have very much of a focus, and so there's not a lot. It feels like it's a lot of setup for this now
five movie
thing, which is just like something that's a big problem in a lot of Hollywood franchises now, and I didn't expect that to happen with this one. So that was just a little disappointing. And it also the fact that it kind of just, because the Newt story is so interesting. And it's like, that's a really fun thing that you're able to latch onto it really well. But the other stories don't quite give you enough time.
To really know what's going on.
To like know what's going on and to care about what's going on. Because it's kind of, they're all shrouded in mystery.
And it moves so fast.
Yeah, and it moves so fast. And so then just when it happens, kind of everything happens at the end. And it's just a little bit like, oh, well, how do we get here? And then all of the plot lines kind of just clumsily converge into each other, and some of them by accident, and so it's just like, it's not like they were invested in it. And then it just, and one of my other big pet peeves, so many movies now also just end with, you know, like New York City being destroyed by a special effect. and I didn't expect that to be a thing that this
it
movie.
Did get
and
fixed.
It does. And then the other biggest problem is like basically the end of the movie, everything is even better and fixed than it was before the start of the movie. So it's like, everything's fine.
Imagine wand was literally waved and everything went back to normal.
Yeah, and then the one like big twist, we know that Johnny Depp's gonna get out. But of all of those negatives, it's like I see the good things, and I think that, you know, I'm very excited about the future movies. Just because also the plot line that they're taking with the...
Yeah.
That's going to be interesting. The war between...
Yeah, because...
Like World War II
they're
and Wizards.
Heading,
yeah,
they're
yeah.
heading towards... Have they cast a young Dumbledore?
They haven't.
No.
Because that's what they're heading towards.
It is, yeah. That's he's going to be in the next movie. They've said that. But it's going to be the big fight between the two of them, which is... Gonna be awesome. But
that's gonna be awesome.
Four movies from now, 2022.
I feel the same way. Where I went in with such high expectations, and J.K. Rowling. I love all the work that she's put out. I love her adult books that I've read. Mm-hmm. I know not critics didn't love all of them, but I did.
Did you read No Vacancy?
Mm-hmm. Casual Vacancy.
Or Casual Vacancy.
I did, and I really liked it. It was weird because it's Harry Potter's voice. But like it's like put in the mind of like young teenage boys that aren't Harry Potter, so they're thinking really dirty thoughts.
Yeah.
Not Harry Potter's voice, but the voice who wrote Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And so that took an adjustment. but I think, especially doing this research, it is her first screenplay, and like that she didn't like find her stride till say 2/3 of the way through. But now she's mapped it all out, and I just have a feeling like it's a slow burn. But I actually firmly believe that it is going to get better.
I think so. I think that actually also gives me just hope, because if I think it'll be more focused, if anything, now that we know exactly where we're going with it. And I guess we wanted to set up, you know, a new world, I guess.
Yeah, to reestablish like the magic world. And, you know, it's in America, so it's different. But
it's
going back to right back to Europe. Yes, this is going to be that like having to set up like, oh, this is the magic world in France or wherever they go next.
That's, I think it's supposed to be Paris.
It's supposed to be Paris. Yeah. The beasts, I think, were the best part. Mm-hmm. And I was sad that they weren't in it more.
Yeah, I wish the beasts would have been more. That's the tone is interesting, because I think it does a good job of being like playful and fun with the scenes. And then it has the dark stuff that came about later in the series.
I think the dark stuff I read was in the rewrites. So as they were rewriting it, it got darker. Oh, but it started off more lighthearted.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, I again, I've said it before, but I think it was just kind of like, a script that wasn't quite there, and then they're working on it, and then it's different, you know, changing perspectives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And all the performances were fine. Like, everything was good. It just needed, like, a little...
Yeah.
A little, not that I could do it.
More of a focus, I guess.
Yeah. Did you like it, Kyle?
Yeah, kind of. I didn't really like any of the Harry Potter movies, to be honest with you. Like, they were all okay. The books were always my preferred method of ingesting the story. And my favorite Harry Potter movie is not my favorite Harry Potter book, also.
What's your favorite movie?
Probably the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah.
The Quran one.
Yeah. It's the only one that feels like it does its own thing rather than just trying to be a...
Yeah.
That and the last two, I think, are fine.
So this movie not having a book about it that I had read before and, like, gobbled up and, like, oh, Newt Scamander, I can't wait to see you. Like, it was a little, I was excited to be back in the world. And when I heard the theme music at the very beginning of the movie, like, do, 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 I was like, got a smile.
John Williams just keeps doing it to me.
But then shortly after, I was like, oh, where's the monsters? I want to see more beasts.
We were talking about how, when this movie first came out, I thought, oh, this is a money grab. This is simply a money grab.
Yeah.
And the thing is, all the people involved in this movie are all the same people who were involved in the other Harry Potter movies. Mm-hmm. They don't need money.
That's true.
That's true. I thought of it as Warner Brothers, and I don't know how much of a hand they had in it. I thought of them as like, we're getting kicked around by Disney as far as our comic book movies go. We're going to hit back with Harry Potter hard.
Maybe, but I don't think Warner Brothers can tell J.K. Rowling what to do.
I don't think they can either. J.K. Rowling informs them. It's like, look, I'm making another movie, so you guys will.
I do think that she genuinely enjoys writing and doing this, because she also said that she was done with the Harry Potter world after she finished Harry Potter, and now she's back.
Yeah, yeah.
And she keeps on adding to Pottermore, the Harry Potter website type blog slash.
Yeah, this
just...
ingest more, ingest more Harry Potter. I took my Patronus quiz last night too.
Yeah, what's your Patronus?
Swallow, a little birdie.
A black swan over here.
Oh, whoa! Yeah. All right, Miley Kunis.
Yeah, Miley.
Miley, Mila.
Whatever. I have a husky.
Oh, that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of that one.
Yeah. I was okay with mine because of the Monty Python bit about the swallows and the coconuts.
Kyle, we talked about what house Matt was in. What house are you in?
Oh, Puff.
Oh, great. Yeah, I see that. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Smart.
Thank you for using the proper terminology.
Yeah, the proper terminology. The smarts.
The smarts.
The purple smarts.
Yeah. Blue smarts.
They're blue?
Yeah.
Right? Blue
smarts.
Yeah. Gotcha.
There was the very original version of it had used the... Legends of the Hidden Temple names. I only thought that there was a moment where I was like, maybe I'm the only one who's going to think this is funny.
What were
those? So it's like silver snakes and red monkeys. And that's what, instead of even just being any of the houses, it was just this
Hidden Temple names.
Yeah. I feel like for the more casual fan, that's a bit, we understand it more.
Exactly. That's actually the one thing. Here, one other plug for the show, I guess. That's the other fun thing about it is that it's like, very... rooted, and there's a lot of, magical world type jokes, but there's also just a lot of real world 90s era, real life things to kind of latch on. There's a lot of Rocky IV references in it, actually.
And Free Willy.
Free Willy. So it's a lot of just stuff that it's not even just the books, but what else your life was surrounded by in the 90s.
You're not worried about Regency getting on you for the Free Willy references?
We can say Free Willy.
I'd totally forgotten, too, that those books do take place in the early 90s.
Early 90s, yeah.
1991. I just assumed they were my age. Yeah. Always.
So, Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Maybe when the next five movies or four movies come out in Fantastic Beasts, you will be back with us.
That's right, if I'm still an expert.
As our resident Harry Potter expert. You can't, once you know something, you never unknow it.
You never forget it.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire Way.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. And we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. We would love it so much. Like a fantastic beast. I would love a fantastic beast. You can find the show on Twitter at dsrapodcast. I can be found on Twitter at klex303. That's K-L-E-X-303.
I can be found at Along With Claire. That's C-L-A-I-R-E. And Matt, where can we find you?
I'm on the Twitter at Matthew V. Cox.
Very clever.
Oh, I guess so.
And for the play, did they go?
And you can find any information about the play at puffstheplay.com, or you can follow it on any of the social medias as Puffs the Play.
Sweet. And you can find our producer, James, who is a part of Puffs the Play, at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R. You can learn more about Fantastic Beasts, Puffs, and general, you know, mythological bestiaries on our Facebook page, where we'll be posting some of our show notes. Our producer, who we normally insult him, but is actually a very successful puff by the name of Cedric, is James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, and she would probably be a smart. You guys agree?
Yeah, or brave.
Up there. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who I'm not sure what he is, but I know he's married to a snake. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.